Monday, it's a new episode of All Rise, the legal drama where one judge is shaking up the system.
When I take the bench, I'm taking a vow to fight for justice.
One case at a time.
Your Honor,
we're going to trial.
Simone Missick is Judge Lola Carmichael.
Up on that bench. Everything is different.
A new episode of All Rise.
Freedom is at stake.
It's important.
Followed by a new episode of Bull, Monday at 9, 8 central on CBS.
Hackers are after your business data. I can help. I am Vi, the virtual intelligence assistant at Virtual Armor.
Virtual Armor, partnered with Juniper Networks, provides cybersecurity services and end-to-end solutions to keep what's yours, yours. Defend yourself with managed firewall and managed SIM essential core services that are economical and efficient. Virtual Armor goes beyond just initial alerting to provide a thorough report on threats, vulnerabilities, and results.
Let me help protect you. Contact me at justaskvi. That's vi.com.
WBT, a radio.com station.
Well, good morning, Carolinas, and happy Father's Day to all you dads. You're listening to Carolina Focus right here on News Talk 1110, 99.3 FM, 107.9 The Link, and 102.5 610 WFNZ. It's also available on podcasts on WBT.com. We are your hosts, Sharon Thorsland and Ed Billick, and now let's get started. This week here in the first half hour, we're going to focus on racial tensions, divided nations. I know it's in the news all over, but Vince Coakley did a wonderful interview with one of the authors that wrote the book, The Language of a Healing Polarized Nation. It's worth a listen. Here's Vince and his guest, author Anita Willis Taylor.
Now we're up to a guest I've been very eagerly looking forward to talking with, and very excited about this. These folks have written a book. I'm referring to three people who have put together a book, A Language of Healing for a Polarized Nation. And if you have any question about whether this nation is polarized, well, you don't have to look any further than the last couple of weeks and the events that have unfolded. And I've told you on this broadcast, we had my good friend Wayne Jacobson has been on this program before. Bob Prater has also been on this broadcast once or twice. For the very first time, we are welcoming the other person who took part in writing this very important and timely book. Had the opportunity to have a couple of conversations with her this week, and she brings a very important piece to this equation. Anita Willis Taylor joining us on the broadcast. Good morning. How are you today?
Good morning, Vince. I'm great. How are you?
Doing very well. The first question I want to ask you, because we'll go into more specific things about the book. We've got a short segment here. I hope you can hold on at least for one more segment. But the first thing that I want to jump into, you've been watching the events of the last few days, beginning with the killing of George Floyd. What do you, would you say is most on your heart right now as it relates to addressing issues and healing?
Most on my heart, actually, what I've seen in the last 2 weeks has been overwhelming. I'm really kind of tired of it, to be honest with you. This is probably not the best morning for me to speak constructively about what I see. At the end of the day, we have to look at police reform and how not to kill people of color, of black and brown people who are in handcuffs with a carotid shutdown of blood flow to their brain. We just can't afford to have the people who are hired to serve and protect not do that. And so that's kind of as far as I'm going to go into it. Everything is so complicated and so multifaceted and so charged right now. I agree, like you, there just needs to be some calm down and some conversations come to the table after the protest.
You know, it's interesting here, and I was quite intrigued to learn, you can explain to people, if I remember correctly, you are in the medical field.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I am a medical technologist. Now we have a very cool name, clinical laboratory scientist, and I did that for 20-plus years. That is my primary first career. That's correct.
Okay. Tell us about how this project came about. We talked, of course, to Wayne Jacobson, Bob Prater. For you, what has been your heart regarding this project, this book, A Language of Healing for a Polarized Nation? How did this project resonate with you from the beginning?
Well, the interesting part for me is I've been talking like this for years. Having these type of conversations is not a new thing for me. Being asked to record my stories and put in a book form was very new, as well as sitting down and having the discussion with two white males. That probably would not have been something I would have chosen to do. In my world, I find that people talk about race a little bit more along homogenous lines. Black people with black people, Hispanic people, Asian people, Indian people, and white people with white people. So it was real interesting to be invited by Wayne and Bob to be a part of this project and have conversations. I will say I am changed forever for the better, and I think they would probably say something very much along the same lines. The book has been so bittersweet. It brought a lot more understanding. And then at the same time, it showed that there is really a big gap in understanding because people don't form relationships with people who are different than them. Everybody wants to go grab a video and watch the news and talk about it. But very few people have people on their phone list that they can call and talk about this. And that's where I'm trying to drive the conversation in the book, A Language of Healing.
Terrific. I assume you are able to hold with us through one more segment. Is that okay with you?
Yes.
Excellent. We're talking with Arnita Willis-Taylor. The book is A Language of Healing for a Polarized Nation. We're having a conversation about how we, in the midst of the polarized country we're in, we began having conversations. The book is called A Language of Healing for a Polarized Nation. One of the authors of that book, Arnita Willis-Taylor, is with us today. You know, and one of the things, you've written this book is a compilation of three people, and the other two are white men, of course. What is it that you bring to the table? When you talked about how you've been impacted by these discussions, how can that dynamic in that relationship you've had with those two guys, how can that be emulated? Because I think a lot of people just don't know where to start. What do we need to do to begin having these discussions across racial and cultural lines?
Well, you have a perfect catalyst right now. We have all kind of people getting in rooms together and doing marches together and singing songs together. And just at least now the climate is much riper to open up and talk about race or politics or sexuality or religion in the country, but particularly race at this time. Sometimes it seems as if to talk about race is a taboo. So as in the book, we model 15 chapters with 15 conversations. You have to start somewhere. But I think probably the question prior to that is, do you want to do this?
Oh, that's good.
Because if you don't see that there's anything in it for you, or you really think you're the end-all, be-all, and you can live the rest of your life the way you are. But if you want to have these type of conversations, why? Define your why. Why is it important? Because if it's not, you will never be motivated to go toward it. So I definitely think we gave a model and some options for how to navigate a conversation without needing to demonize people who do not see it the way I see it, and to just be able to listen for learning and understanding. And that's really needed. You would think that that's common courtesy. It isn't.
Not very common at all. No question no. about that, Arnie. One of the things that this is something that goes to mind. Maybe you can help me with this, because I've had discussions with everybody on all sides of this over the last few days. And here's one of the things that stands out to me, because I think I speak for a lot of people who feel this way, that there sometimes you can feel like unless you agree with that other person, that person will tell you, I'm not being heard. How do you bridge that gap? Because I hearing does not necessarily mean I'm going to agree and come over to your side.
That's true. I think it all depends on your reaction to it. What I find, or it has been my experience, when I am telling my truth or something that I want people to learn, there's always this reaction to respond to what I say. That's normally the problem. I'm not asking you to respond. I'm really just asking you to listen. I cannot determine if you feel heard or not. when I'm on the other side of it. But I don't have to defend and deflect and deter off of what you're saying. In this country, in my experiences, most people make everything about them. We use the word narcissist way too loosely. That is really a serious term. But most people are very self-aggrandized and will see everything as to how it relates to them. Let me give an example. The other day, I've gotten hundreds of texts from people, text calls, hundreds. I can't even respond to them. And there was one friend, and she said, "So tell me, what can I do? What can I do so that we are not perpetuating this type of treatment of humans in America?" She has two pretty young children, and this was a text form. This wasn't in a verbal communication format. And I said, "You know, one of the best things you can do is you can raise your two children to be great human beings and to love all people awesome. The way they're made. You have the next generation in your home. You can model that." Well, I could tell from her response that she assumed I was saying she wasn't doing that. I wasn't.
Oh, man.
But she made that about her. But you asked me the question. I find that dynamic happening a lot. You asked me the question, and then you made it about you. But I was just giving you my answer.
That's really good. And this gets to the heart of what doesn't happen often enough, and that is simply listening. That's not something we do very well, is it?
It's not, because listening involves so much. It involves so much, and then it involves you to do so little. Sometimes you listen for what you can understand, and then there's other times you have to listen for the undertones of what maybe is not being said. But that the things that's not being said, if you sense that, it gives you a great opportunity to ask another question, which will always spur a conversation. We talk about that a lot in A Language of Healing. A well-placed question is always good. And if people are just intimidated by your questions, then you probably need to cease the conversation. You're probably not going to get anywhere.
I know exactly what you're talking about here. I can't believe that we're running out of time so quickly. Only have about a minute left. I want to go back to this issue because I think is absolutely important, what you said about desire. Let's say somebody honestly says today, "I don't have the desire." What do you do?
Nothing. Then we don't need to have a conversation. Again, people can live their whole life socially secluded, socially segregated. It's not mandated by law, but you can do that. You can totally live that life if you want to. Just don't get into the conversations of the people who do. That's my beef with social media. There are some people who always make comments. You have no intention of building relationships with people who are different. Then to me, I would say, just be quiet. Go live your life. You can do that. that could decrease a whole lot of confusion.
That would serve people well. And that's a great takeaway from this. If your heart isn't toward relationship and building relationship, silence is golden. It absolutely is. The book is called A Language of Healing for a Polarized Nation. Arnita Willis Taylor is one of the authors. Arnita, thanks a lot for coming in. We will definitely have you back again another time. God bless you. Have a good weekend.
Thank you. Thank you.
Excellent piece with Vince Coakley. Now let's move over to How to Heal a Divided City. Last Friday, Bo Thompson on WBT Morning News had a wonderful discussion with our police chief here in the city of Charlotte, Kerr Putney. And let me tell you, for me, it was leadership on display. His calm manner, his thoughtfulness in how he expresses the situation, responds versus reacts. A clear thinker, we are honored to have Police Chief Kerr Putney to be our police chief. He definitely role models what a police chief should be. So let's take a listen to Bo's interview with Police Chief Kerr Putney, the city of Charlotte.
Let's go straight to the WBT hotline and welcome back to the show, CMPD Chief Kerr Putney. Good morning, Chief.
Good morning, Bo.
I appreciate you being here, as always. And things, as best I can tell, seem to have calmed down last night for the most part. One of the quieter nights, if not the quietest, as it relates to protests in Charlotte. Would you agree with that?
Actually, I do agree, Bo. We've had about three, maybe four nights where it's been relatively peaceful. People continue to protest, which is fine. They get the word out, but haven't had any issues whatsoever, and hoping that continues.
I know we had that incident with, what, about 20, 25 people on 277 the night before last. But outside of that, are you anticipating, what are you anticipating this weekend?
Again, but we're just going to be ready for whatever, whatever comes our way. Don't know anything major that's potentially going to happen negative, but at any given time, you can have a small group of people who want to do something violent or destructive, and we got to be prepared for that throughout the weekend. And our people are ready. I'm proud of what the officers are doing. They're working so long hours, and they're prepared for whatever comes their way.
Well, I certainly want to ask you about some Charlotte issues, but I want to talk about some nationwide stuff, too, because there's a lot going on. I assume you're following the developments in Seattle right now?
Sure. Lots of cities across the country are having some issues. Yes, I am following that, Bo.
So for listeners who don't know the latest, demonstrators took over City Hall in Seattle for an hour Tuesday night. They seized control of a six-block area. They were peaceful, but they demanded for the mayor to step down if she refused to defund the city's police. And the protesters have occupied this Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone, or as some people call it there, Chief, they call it a cop-free zone. What do you think about what you see happening there?
It's hard to really figure that out, Bo. I get the desire to want reform. You see us locally continuing to make changes to get better. However, there's a way to go about it so that we can be more strategic, substantive, and impactful. Because I think there comes a point where these overly aggressive methods, you lose the support you have because people feel like it's becoming too extreme. So everybody's entitled to the First Amendment, but at some point, some of these methods, you start to lose credibility.
And I also want to ask you about Minneapolis, of course, the place where these latest rounds of protests started. That's where George Floyd was killed, obviously. So in Minneapolis, the city council there is going to disband the city's police department. Disband. It's a lot different word than defund. The idea of disbanding a police department altogether, just in a general sense, what's your reaction to that notion?
Well, words matter, Bo. They make reference to Camden, New Jersey in particular, but at last check, they do have a police department. So the word reimagine comes up as well. Mm-hmm. I think that's a safer word than disband, but I think both of them have the same kind of connotation. People want to see something different. Unfortunately, the 911 calls will not stop. So while people are trying to reimagine and disband, somebody's going to have to do the work to keep people safe. And I can think of no better institution to do that than the police. Police aren't perfect. Police have to make improvements. But until there's a opportunity to do something different, was still necessary.
Well, and they say they're going to rely on community-led public safety strategies. I'm not sure I even understand what that really means.
Well, when you figure it out, let me know. There are a lot of sanitized and well-meaning words, but at the end of the day, we got to figure out exactly what it is the community wants from their police department so that we can come together and make those things work. But defunding, disbanding, reimagining, all those terms sound great until you really get down to what's going to happen when somebody needs help, who's going to respond, and right now the best people suited for that, although not perfect, the best people suited for that are police officers.
Well, I saw a meme on the internet somewhere this week. I can't take credit for this, but I've been thinking about it ever since I saw it, and it shows a 911 operator, and it says, when police departments are defunded, here's how it goes. The caller says, help, somebody's breaking into my house, and the 911 operator says, stay calm, sir, we're sending our thoughts and prayers right now.
Yeah, Bo, I know. It's quite telling that this idea, this concept, we have to put some real practical matters around it so that it can be implemented, whatever that might be. But I don't see where replacing the police function is going to get us to a place of having safer cities. So, again, if we do it collaboratively, I think we can reform and get better as a police service. But the idea of disbanding, removing police completely is just totally impractical.
And some of these other headlines, and we're talking to Chief Kerr Putney live here on WBT's Morning News, some of these other headlines across the country, I mention these because I'm leading towards a question about Charlotte, but police will stop responding to non-criminal calls in San Francisco. In Louisville, elimination of no-knock search warrants. Denver, Colorado, in just the last few hours, the school board there has voted to end its contract with the Denver Police Department. So I assume that means resource officers are not in schools anymore. I mean, you hear these headlines. Does it creep into your mind and your force that maybe the defunding that happened last Monday night in Charlotte, are these initial steps down a road that could end in Charlotte for, you know, one of these other scenarios? Do you worry about that?
I don't, actually, Bo. I just our mission is still to prevent and to fight crime, and we're going to continue to do that. What I do see this as an opportunity to responsibly reform, and I'm willing to engage with anybody. I've been pretty clear in that. I've demonstrated that for quite some time now. However, I think the knee-jerk reactions are going to, you know, there's going to be a cost to them. And unfortunately, the people who can afford that cost least are going to be most impacted. So it's disappointing. We're going to continue to be professionals, get better, and do our work as police service because that's what the community expects.
CMPD Chief Kerr Putney with me here on WBT. I'm Bo Thompson. Charlotte Pride just announced that it's banning law enforcement agencies from participating in or serving as vendors in the annual parade and festival. Now the parade events have been canceled this year because of COVID-19, but when that parade comes back in 2021, Chief, it will continue to be the city's largest parade. They're also asking the city to make cops less visible who will provide public safety at future Pride events. Again, I sound like a broken record, but these headlines, how do you react as a police force and a police chief to that?
Well, the truth of the matter, Bo, is we've had a great relationship with the Pride event for quite a while. Last year was the first time we actually had officers who marched in it. So we're trying to support our officers and their lifestyles. We thought that was a milestone for us. This, obviously, the headlines, as you say, is a setback. However, the devil's in the details. We're going to see exactly what that looks like at the end of the day. That's one of the largest events we have in the city, and we still need the police to make it safe. It's just going to be have to be determined what that's going to look like moving forward. We're open to it. I just, again, the headlines, though, Bo, are sometimes a screen for change. So I've learned the best way to approach that is to let cooler heads prevail, let things calm down a bit, and get really down to the practical application of what change looks like so that we can continue to ensure safety.
So 2 weeks ago tonight, the first wave of protests began here in Charlotte, Chief Putney, and that was, of course, on Beatty's Ford Road that night. What have you learned about your city in the last 14 days?
Well, this city is very resilient, Bo. This city is, just like many cities across the country, at a crossroads. We got to choose the path that we want to take, but we need to do so with our eyes open. We can't let emotion override logic. We're going to have to get to where we're strategically looking at the reforms that we want to make. But the other thing about the city is we're in a position in a crossroad right now where we got to determine if we want to come together as a city, as a community, or if we want to be divided like the rest of the country and pay those consequences. Hopefully we'll choose the former.
Final thing, Chief Putney, again, headlines that I have to read twice to make sure they're right. here on Friday morning, the 12th of June. The bulk of the Republican National Convention is going to Jacksonville. And the way I understand it now, after all the talk and back and forth about planning this convention, and even as it affects you and your retirement and you being on the force, now we come to find out that apparently there's going to be the quote-unquote business part of the convention happening for one day on Monday, the 24th of August, with about 350 people. And then they're all going to head down to Jacksonville. And so what we thought was going to be this huge event is now anything but. The RNC in Jacksonville, what do you think about all this?
Well, I'm glad we're on the radio. You can't see me smiling. It's a pretty big smile. So I don't want a meme of that showing, so I'm glad again that we're on the radio. Truthfully, we're trying to figure it out exactly what that means for us here locally, obviously. This is a pretty major change. We're going to support Jacksonville in any way we can, but also hosting the smaller contingent here. We're going to make them safe as well. It's going to be a good event. It is a substantial change, and we're trying to make sense of exactly what that looks like for us. But again, I got the confidence in the personnel here at CMPD. We're unwavering. We have good partners with the community members here who are still going to make the event a success, and we'll just see what comes.
And I assume by what you're saying right there, the fact that this thing is going to be so much more of a small scale than it was, that doesn't affect anything about your exit plan, does it?
Very good question, Bo. We'll see what happens. Right now, I don't know what the scale looks like, the scope, and what the details are just yet. As that develops, I will keep you posted.
Chief Putney, you always do. I appreciate it, and thank you for coming on this morning.
Thank you for what you do, Bo.
Great discussion with our police chief, Kerr Putney. He's a wonderful man, a wonderful leader. We're blessed to have him as our police chief here in the city of Charlotte. He's got a big job. All right, let's switch up gears here on Carolina Focus. Sharon Forsland recently caught up with Dr. Monroe Richardson, who talks about the importance of teaching kids how to read. Reading is the future for future success with our children. Here's Sharon.
All right, thanks for joining us here on Carolina Focus. We have a very special guest today, Dr. Monroe Richardson. He is the Executive Director of Read Charlotte. Thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Richardson.
Thank you for having me.
Well, for people that might not be familiar with what Read Charlotte is, can you give us a little bit of background about the program?
Sure. So Read Charlotte is a community initiative. We were started in 2015. Our goal is to coordinate, integrate, and align all of the work happening around Mecklenburg County to improve children's literacy from birth all the way through third grade. We have really benefited from a tremendous amount of partnership and energy around improving early literacy. We know that third grade in particular is the dividing line between learning to read and reading to learn. And it's actually one of the biggest predictors of how well children will do in school and in life after school. And so our community really rallied together 5 years ago to really focus on this issue for Charlotte Mecklenburg.
Well, speaking of reading to learn and third grade, I actually have a third grader, just had his little graduation ceremony last night. And I know that it has been a big time challenge for students all over the world with the COVID-19 shutdown, and CMS and all most of the other local school systems have finished up within the past week or so. And now it's summertime. But the last quarter of school was done all remotely. How, in your opinion, is this going to impact student progress, particularly with reading, when they've been home for the past 3 months trying to learn over a computer?
Right. So we just had and a grand experiment in our country, rapidly moving to online or remote learning. You know, some of the press reporting that I've seen suggests that it's been mixed. Some communities were more prepared for this than others, whether it's devices. I don't think anyone, certainly in a K-12 context, had really done serious remote learning the way that we've done it these past 3 months. I've heard our superintendent refer to this as interrupted instruction. And I think our educators know that the instruction that children received over the past 3 months is not the same that they would have had were they in regular classroom. In fact, McKinsey & Company, the consulting company, last week put out a report where they've estimated what is the likely impact of the interrupted instruction in our country. They say that the average student in the fall will be behind by 7 months. That's 7 months of learning loss. Wow. And then when they've broken this out, across groups, low-income kids in particular, they say will be behind by over a year. So the impact, you know, is enormous, I think, for our country. And if we're not serious and intentional, we're going to have an entire generation of children that could be permanently impacted by the COVID-19 induced school closures.
Those are some scary statistics. I have three children, as I was saying. One of them just finished third grade, and I've been concerned about that for months now. I mean, I've been doing my best to try to be the homeschool teacher, but not everybody has that luxury. A lot of parents I know had to work full-time and trying to juggle, even as a part-time person, it's hard to juggle the homeschool and the work environment. And when you hear those numbers that your children could be anywhere from 7 to 12 months behind in their learning, it makes you go, wow, what can we do about this? And I know that you guys at Reach Charlotte have come up with a plan for this summer, at least, to try to help kids regain some of that learning loss, and I'm particularly focused on the reading. Tell us a little bit about this program.
And Dr. Monroe Richardson will do just that right here at Carolina Focus when we come back. Well, welcome back to Carolina Focus on this Father's Day 2020. You're listening to Carolina Focus on News Talk 1110, 99.3 WBT, 107.9 The Link, and 102.5 610 WFNZ. You know, it's also available on the podcast on WBT.com. We are your co-hosts, Sharon Thorsland. I'm Ed Billick. Again, happy Father's Day to you dads, you granddads, and all of you that provide fatherly guidance. All right, let's continue the discussion with Dr. Monroe Richardson, helping kids with reading.
I know that you guys at Read Charlotte have come up with a plan for this summer, at least, to try to help kids regain some of that learning loss, and I'm particularly focused on the reading. Tell us a little bit about this program.
Right. So we obviously became concerned in mid-March when schools closed here in Mecklenburg County, and we began to really think hard about what we could do. By mid-April, you know, our assumption at the time was families are home. None of us knew what was going to happen with the coronavirus school opening. And even today in early June, we still don't quite know what's going to happen in the fall. So we partnered with a company based in California called Learning Ovations, who we had been talking with about a classroom-based solution that they've developed and proven out over a number of years to assist teachers to inform their reading instruction. The U.S. Department of Education had asked them if they would release a home-based version of that for parents. So they did so in early April. And after we looked at it, we thought it had a lot of promise. But the area we really needed to work on was how do we make this more user-friendly for families? And so we spent the last 2.5 months working with Learning Ovations as well as some local partners here in Charlotte, including Charlotte Mecklenburg Schools, to develop what we call the Reading Checkup campaign. We created a site called readingcheckup.org where families can go. You'll be able to get links to where you can go find out your child's reading level. So for rising kindergarten through rising fourth graders, what's your child's current reading level? You will get recommendations for where the areas that you need to prioritize for your child to help them improve their reading. And then we work to curate over 250 activities, many that are easy to do at home, don't require a printer or computer, but that parents can use aligned with the quiz results that their kids get, and then be able to know, here's exactly what I can do to help my child improve their reading this summer.
Wow, that sounds like a great tool for parents to be able to use. Is this something that, is it easy access? You just go to this website and it doesn't require a whole lot of, it's user-friendly.
So we've done our best to make it as user-friendly as possible. You go to readingcheckup.org. There will be a link that'll take you to where you can go and get a checkup, find out your child's reading level. It's all free, so there's no cost to parents. But what we try to do is make it easy for parents to be able to figure out, where's my child? What do I need to do to help him or her move forward? We're also going to be this summer offering virtual family literacy events. We're calling these Reading Checkup Live, where we will be helping parents understand how to go through the reading checkup. We'll be answering questions that they have so that they can feel confident about using this tool this summer to help their child with their reading.
Wow, that sounds really exciting. What are some of the, you're saying you can go to these links after you figure out where your child is at. What are some of those activities and some of those different links that, can you just describe them in a little more detail?
Sure. So when it comes to children and their reading, in particular helping them with reading, there's really two big areas of focus. There are skills kids need to develop to learn phonics, to be able to sound out words. And then there are skills kids need to be able to develop their comprehension skills. And within those two big buckets, some activities are best to be led by an adult, and some of those are independent work. And what the quiz will do is tell you how much of those four different types of activities your child needs, what you should prioritize. And then you can use that information to identify specific literacy activities that you can do with your child. So for example, there'll be activities that'll be recommended around shared reading or things you can do to help build the vocabulary. You might have a child that is earlier in their reading development and needs help with learning their letters or letter sounds. They might need help with rhyming words. And so you'll get these kind of a menu of things that you could do at home. Some of these will be activities that you can literally sit down and do with your child. Some of these might be things you can rope in to wear while you're cooking or other things that you're doing as well. They're all intended to really help you understand, here's what I can do. And to help make it easier for families, we've also indicated how much time it would take to do the activity. So if you've got 30 minutes, you can easily pick some activities that fit within that time block that you can do. And if you've got more time, you can pick more activities as well. So we're trying to make it as user-friendly as possible for families and to help them figure out how they can fit this into their schedules. As you said, there's a lot of other things going on. There's work, there's a lot of other things. And we're trying to work with our families and our community partners to figure out how to make this as family friendly as possible.
I like the sound of that because it's difficult to do it all. So it's great that you guys are making this so targeted and user friendly and say, okay, you've got 10 minutes here, you've got 10 minutes there, because it is hard to get a child to sit down and want to do this, especially now that it's summer vacation. It's harder to sort of rope them in and get them to do some of these reading activities. So that's neat that you've got it so parents can sort of manage this in a really realistic way.
Yeah, I think that last part you said was really important. We need to be realistic. We're not asking parents to be teachers. what we are saying is here are some things that you can do with your child or have your child do that's targeted to their specific needs. And this goes well beyond just getting a big list of activities. You can find those anywhere online, but to really have a set of activities that's targeted to exactly where your child is at, we think this is a real leap forward in helping families, but also helping children.
Yeah, and I want to dive in a little bit more to what you were saying earlier on, learning to read versus reading to learn. I know people might hear that phrase and say, well, what exactly is the difference? Can you sort of talk about that a little bit?
Sure. So, you know, when a child starts school in kindergarten, you know, the most important job of a child in those first several years is learning to read. Everything else that happens in school after third grade is really dependent on a child having strong reading skills. So we teach them everything from, you know, how to understand letters and letter sounds and how to sound out words, and then how to, you know, once you're able to read with enough speed and accuracy to then be able to make sense of the text that you're reading, to understand not only the words on the page, but the ideas about what you're reading, to be able to evaluate text and connect it to other ideas, your own life experiences. And this is what it means to be able to read well and to do what some people call meaning making from text that you read. Once you get into fourth grade, though, you're really expected to be able to use those reading skills to study science, social studies, even word problems and math. And so a child that's able to understand the text they're reading well, will be able to engage in those subjects. But if you're still struggling with getting meaning from words off the page, you really are challenged when it comes to being able to engage in these other subjects. I've seen somewhere that 85% of the curriculum in grades 4 to 12 is reading based. So if you're not able to read well, you're really challenged. And our systems overall are really geared towards teaching children how to read in grades K to 3. But once you get past third grade, it really shifts more into using your reading skills to learn as opposed to teaching you how to read. And so that's why it becomes really imperative for us to make sure in those first 4 years of school, kindergarten through third grade, that we're doing everything we can to help children be strong readers by the end of third grade. And just to give you a sense of what I mean, Charlotte's Web, it is the perfect example of a book that a child should be able to read on their own by the time they're entering fourth grade, right?
Okay.
And so a child's able to read Charlotte's Web and understand it well, and some of the ideas in the book, because Charlotte's Web is full of big ideas. What does it mean to be a runt, right? and what does it mean to be overlooked and to have low expectations for what Wilbur, could do? What does it mean to have friendship? Think about Charlotte and Wilbur. Lots of really rich ideas in that text. But if you're not able to read well, you can't engage it, much less get those ideas out of the book. And so that's what our aspiration is for every child in our community, is to be able to enjoy Charlotte's Web or whatever book that he or she enjoys, but to really be able to make meaning and to understand that, which is the very beginning of the process of developing an informed citizenry, right? That, is able to understand what's going on in the world around them, that's able to participate, that's able to be a productive citizen. Being able to be illiterate is really a gateway to a lifetime of opportunity.
And I always say to learn a love for reading. I love to read. It's hard to get children to love to read when I think if it's difficult for them to read, obviously, and if they're not grasping things, it's like, go read for 30 minutes and they're like breezing through things. Do you have any suggestions for parents on how to encourage your child to help them gain a love for reading, something that'll last them a lifetime?
Well, one of the really critical factors in learning to love to read is being able to read. And so helping them with those skills is really important, to be able to learn to sound out words, read with enough speed and accuracy. I do think that one of the most powerful things that families can do with their child is reading with them. At Read Charlotte, we call this active reading, where you're not just reading the words on the page, but you're really using the book as a way to have a conversation with your child. So you're doing what we call the ABCs. You're asking questions about what you're reading. You're building vocabulary. So you're talking about new words they're encountering. And you're also connecting the text to the child's world. So the idea, so for example, when I talked about Charlotte's Web, and you've got the runt, Wilbur, right? Talking about what that means to be kind of overlooked or to have low expectations, to talk about the friendship between Charlotte and Wilbur, and to talk about what it means to have a friend and what impact that makes on you. All sorts of really rich ideas in children's books. And one of the great thing about children's books is children's book authors typically don't write down to children. They have high expectations. And so if you look at the vocabulary in a typical children's book, picture book, there's pretty high vocabulary. A lot of them have really big ideas, and they're rich opportunities to build children's language and vocabulary and comprehension skills. And so really, the love and motivation of reading begins in the lap of a, caring adult. We think that obviously this is something that's open to a lot of parents. You don't have to have a PhD to be able to sit down with your child and spend time with them and read with them. And children respond to it. And so we know that parents know their child, they know what they're interested in. We're fortunate we have a wonderful library in our community, Charlotte Mecklenburg Library, great children's librarians that will help parents find books that their kids would be interested in. So we have a lot of resources in our community to help. But fundamentally, at the end of the day, the parent is the biggest influence on their child and really can help create the love of reading that you're talking about.
All right. Well, it's a neat program that you guys have just in Read Charlotte, number one, but this learning, this reading experience over the summer, the reading checkup that you guys have developed. Tell us again where people can find that information if they want to access that this summer.
Yes, so families can just go to readingcheckup.org and you'll find all the information you need to know how to go find out your child's current reading level, what are the reading skills they need to focus on this summer, and what are the activities you can do to help meet their individual needs.
All right. I know I will be jumping right on that website with my soon-to-be fourth grader. So it sounds like a really great program, and a lot of people should be able to get a lot of help from that this summer. So thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Monroe Richardson, the Executive Director of Read Charlotte. We really appreciate the time. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Great discussion. Thank you, Sharon. Okay, on this Father's Day, Vince Coakley talked the book on Divided Nation. He interviewed the author, so you can listen to any of this and go back to the podcast. Also, Bo Thompson had a great discussion with our police chief, Kerr Putney, on racial tensions and what's going on in the city. We've talked about how to get kids caught up in their reading. Now it's time to move to the coronavirus, the pandemic that has shaken this nation terribly in the past few months. This is a discussion with North Carolina 3rd District Congressman Greg Murphy, M.D. Yes, I did say M.D. He's not only a congressman here in the state of North Carolina, he's a medical professional, a medical doctor. Let's catch up with Greg Murphy, M.D.
I want to welcome back on the WBT Hotline. We have talked to him periodically throughout this COVID-19 pandemic. He is U.S. Congressman from District Number 3, North Carolina, Dr. Greg Murphy. Welcome back.
Good morning. Good morning. I hope you guys are all well.
We're doing okay. Appreciate you being here. You are a congressman. You are a physician. So all during this COVID-19 pandemic, you've been an interesting person to talk to, I think, because you look at this through a couple of different lenses, or at least two different lenses, very important ones. And I want to start off the conversation here with what Governor Cooper talked about yesterday, Congressman, and that is the idea of requiring face masks. Now, face masks are currently required only for some workers, like healthcare providers and employees of salons and personal care businesses. They generally are not required of customers or for anybody out there, you know, going about day-to-day activities in the public. Encouraged, yes, but not required. So before I get your take on this, this is what the Governor Cooper said yesterday.
It's absolutely in discussion right now regarding whether we make cloth face coverings mandatory and in what way we do it. Right now, they are mandatory for employees of personal care, like nail and hair salons. They're required for those employees. But our health experts are looking at those same studies showing the effectiveness of cloth face coverings. We want people voluntarily to do this, but we are looking at additional rules to potentially make these mandatory.
Dr. Murphy, do you feel like that's where we're headed?
Well, first of all, something like that, in my opinion, is unenforceable. It just doesn't make sense otherwise. I will tell you, and maybe possibly I'm in somewhat slight agreement with the governor here, is that the data has changed. We thought at first really only symptomatic people who were coughing, were best needing to wear masks. But, you know, these masks don't prevent individual virus particles from coming out. They won't do that. They're not 100%, especially the cloth mask that he's talking about. But, you know, they do prevent the gross spillage of droplets, and that's where the majority of virus particles come from. That's why I wear one in the operating room. So if I have a cough or if I have something, I'm not putting something in the wound. I also wear it to protect myself from blood or debris or anything else that we have in the operating room. You know, I am at the point where I wear one out in public. I recommend them. You know, if you're in close contact with somebody, in other words, your time to exposure to that other person is an extended period of time, not just a brief walk in the hall. I think that, again, I went on social media 2 months ago and talked about hair salons and all these other things because I thought we could have opened them up 2 months ago, really. But, you know, for the general public, I would urge people to do it. But I don't believe requiring everybody to wear a mask at all times and things like that is number one, you know, plausible. You're just not going to be able to do that. And two, I just don't see that as necessary.
As far as the reopening goes and the speed at which North Carolina is going in relation to South Carolina and Tennessee, I mean, we just were talking earlier about the fact that the NASCAR All-Star Race is moving to Tennessee come July 15th from Charlotte because they can have 30,000 people in the stands in Tennessee, and we can't, obviously. And if you listen to Governor Cooper and HHS Secretary Cohen, and also our Mecklenburg County health officials within the last several days, the theme seems to be that the numbers are concerning, and we need to be careful here.
Well, it's just very interesting when we talk about the numbers, Bo, is that Dr. Birx, who, you know, obviously works on the president's COVID-19 task force, I've been in discussions with her a lot, with Dr. Fauci's team, et cetera. And Dr. Birx called Dr. Cohen because she was concerned about our persistent, continued rise at this. Now, Dr. Birx was very clear that it did not have to do with reopening. And unfortunately, I think that message was not delivered in that manner by the governor's staff. I think the message was said it was otherwise, but from Dr. Birx's lips, that's what she said. And, you know, we had the lawsuit about the racetrack here in North Carolina. Wouldn't it have been nice if we had a governor that said to the racetrack owner, hey, let's sit down for a minute. Let's talk about this situation. Let's figure out a pathway forward that we both can accept rather than saying, oh, you're a bad guy and I'm going to sue you. You know, that's just not the way that you govern. You govern by discussion. You govern by communication. You govern by transparency, which during this entire process, they have been flat out miserable at doing.
Do you think North Carolina is ready for phase three?
I do. But here's the caveat. You know, we've had two or three endpoints during this entire discussion. Number one is, you know, pushing down the curve was to get hospitals ready for surges. And our hospitals are ready. They are ready. Now, the number of people hospitalized has gone up, but it's now in a sawtooth pattern, essentially leveled off. What we have seen, a very good thing, is that the number of deaths, the endpoint that none of us want, have plummeted. And if you look at that curve, it's a very, very encouraging curve because, you know, we're sheltering the people that we need to shelter. Mm-hmm. And so and we're also taking care of the ones in a better way than we were at the beginning. So, yeah, I think the healthy individual under age 65, yes, let us start living our lives again. We cannot keep running from this. It is not going to go away. We need to just continue to learn with it, to learn to live with it, rather.
Dr. Murphy, I appreciate your insight as always. Thanks for calling in.
God bless. Everybody stay safe, and let's start life again, right?
Always great insights from Congressman Greg Murphy, not only a legislator but an MD. And his whole intent, his whole talks on face masks. I mean, Sharon, you're on a little vacation. You're calling in from where are you sitting right now?
I'm at Polly's Island right now, and it's just heavenly out.
You're in the Carolinas, of course, and you're on the beach.
I am. I'm sitting on the beach, and nobody has on a face mask around me, but I've seen a whole lot of face masks down here in the grocery store at different places. I haven't gone a lot of places, but I have seen a lot of face masks, thankfully. I'm a big proponent of those.
And, you know, and rightfully,
that's all we want.
And rightfully yeah. slow, especially when you're out in the public. But is there a difference in how folks are taking this virus, you know, at the beach life or back here in the city of Charlotte?
Yeah, I can tell a huge difference. Number one, just every restaurant we drive by is packed. People outside, I mean, you don't need one outside, obviously, but every restaurant we've driven by, it appears to be packed. And the mask usage is probably about half of what it is in Charlotte. So I'm not sure if people just think they're getting fresher air here or what, but the mask usage is about half of what it is in Charlotte.
Interesting. Hey, we got about a minute to go. What do you have coming up in future shows? You've been getting some great interviews. I know I got one coming up. I'll share that. So, but what do you have scheduled?
Yeah, well, I spoke with Julie Emmons. She is the founder and director of the Carolina Film Foundation, or Film Community, which is a really neat group of film people involved in the film business. And they're talking about what they're doing right now and a really neat contest they've come up with to encourage people to create their own short film.
And I think you have a son-in-law. I have a sister who's a registered nurse, and your son-in-law is in the medical profession. It's going to be wonderful to get their insights on what it's like in that profession, obviously, during this virus.
Yes, it's my brother-in-law. Don't have a son-in-law quite yet.
Oh, okay. What am I thinking? What am I saying? Because I have a son-in-law. Go ahead.
Yes. My brother-in-law is an emergency room doctor, and he's seen some really interesting things, needless to say, since the COVID-19 crisis started.
Hey, Sharon, thanks for all you do, and happy Father's Day to your husband there and all the other fathers out there here from Carolina Focus.
Thanks so much. Same to you, Ed.
That's Carolina Focus here on a Father's Day. Folks, enjoy your Sunday. Talk to you all next week.
Monday, it's a new episode of All Rise, the legal drama where one judge is shaking up the system.
When I take the bench, I'm taking a vow to fight for justice.
One case at a time.
Your Honor,
we're going to trial.
Simone Missick is Judge Lola Carmichael.
Up on that bench. Everything is different.
A new episode of All Rise.
Freedom is at stake. It's important.
Followed by a new episode of Bull, Monday at 9, 8 central on CBS.